Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. The plastics industry is worth an estimated $4 trillion. The industry generates 300 million tons of plastic every year, nearly half of which is for single-use items, meaning that it will almost instantly become trash. In 2016, 760 million tons of scrap plastic from the U.S. was sent to China, but that figure plummeted by a whopping 95% in 2018 after China decided to tighten standards for the recycling materials it would accept. So with China refusing to take our trash, the United States' inability to properly recycle and dispose of its plastic waste has become more evident. Some U.S. cities have stopped their plastics recycling programs altogether. According to today's guest, reporter Sharon Lerner, the plastics industry has a long history of blaming pollution on us, on citizens. The industry has also waged a fight against environmentalists who are working to reduce plastic waste, and they're working with states to pass so-called bans on bans. So the state bans prevent cities from passing plastic bag bans, for example. We now know about the health and environmental impact of plastics. So what will it take to really take on this industry and truly tackle this problem? Sharon Lerner has written extensively about plastics and the chemical industry. Sharon is an award-winning health and environment reporter for The Intercept and a reporting fellow at Type Investigations. Her work has appeared in many publications, including The New York Times and The Nation, and her series, The Teflon Toxin, was a finalist for a National Magazine Award. Hi, Sharon. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us, and thank you for your extensive reporting on this. I really hope that listeners have a chance to read your long piece about the plastics industry really blaming all of this on citizens and their plan to keep polluting the world. Sharon, let's talk about where we are today. You report that in 1967, less than 25 million tons of plastics were produced every year. By 1980, it doubled. 10 years later, in 1990, it doubled again. So where are we today?
Well, we make a huge amount of plastic today, more than 300 million tons a year. It's an incredibly lucrative industry, trillions of dollars. And we, as you know, a planet, don't have adequate ways of disposing of it. And, you know, part of the way we've been told that this is okay is, well, we recycle it.
Right.
But in truth, we have not been able to recycle the vast majority of the plastics that we produce. So 8.3 billion metric tons of plastic, and that's just an enormous number, and it's hard to conceive of. So basically, but that is the amount that we have ended up scattering over around the world in landfills, and that is almost 80% of the plastic that's ever been produced has ended up not being recycled and ended up in landfills and littering the world. And in the U.S., you know, we think, oh, we have, and compared to some other countries, we do have a better infrastructure, better ability to recycle plastics. But even in a, you know, an industrialized nation such as our own, we've only ever managed to recycle the highest amount we ever reached. Our peak as a nation was in 2014 when we recycled 9.5% of plastic. And the crazy thing about that is that the plastic that we were shipping to China in those years, that was classified as recycled, even though we now know that most of that was being dumped and burned in China. So, in essence, we do recycle some, but the vast majority of it does not get recycled. And there are only really two kinds of plastic that are worth anything in the recycling market today. And those are the, you know, on the bottom when you can see the numbers, those are types one and two that are reliably, you know, about, I believe it's about 30 or 33% of the bottles made of those kinds of plastic get recycled. But the other things, those other categories, you know, three and four and six and seven, they're virtually worthless in the recycling market.
You also report that less than 1% of the tens of billions of plastic bags used in the United States every year are recycled.
Yeah, the bags, and those numbers, I have to say, it's pretty much impossible. We know that it's less than 1%. I think that it is probably much less than 1%. It's impossible to get real numbers on this, very specific numbers. But we know the vast majority are not recycled. And part of what broke my heart when I was reporting this is that even in those film recycling programs, and I don't know if you know that of these, but around the country, mostly in supermarkets, they have these like plastic bag recycling programs. And these are separate from the bottles that you put in, clear blue bags for a lot of curbside recycling, because plastic bags often snag up recycling, other kinds of plastic recycling systems. So they do them separately. And I myself have been loyally, trying to collect the bags that inevitably pass through our household, even though we try really, really hard to avoid them, for years, right? And thinking, well, if I bring them to this bring back program, this drop off program, that they'll get recycled. Well, it turns out that in the past couple of years, even the recycling program this nationwide program that is backed in part by the EPA and actually also supported by the American Chemistry Council Industry Trade Group, that program has actually wound up sending some of those bags to landfill, and that's really disheartening. So most of them, of course, just get thrown out. Directly. But even the ones that you bring to the recycling program are often landfilled or thrown out.
Wow. Because in San Francisco, for example, we got a notice, I think it was earlier this year or last year, that said if you put all your plastic bags in one big bag and tie it, it will be recycled. And the San Francisco Chronicle and the New York Times, if you get those papers, every single day they're wrapped in a plastic bag. That's a lot of plastic. Why do these companies still do that? I mean, I guess you could say they do it during the rain so the paper stays dry, but why do they do it in the summer?
Companies, that I don't know. But I can tell you, big picture, one of the ways that people have been fighting back about this is to pass bag bans.
Right.
And it's obvious why you would, because people really adjust. When these bans are in place, they change their behavior, and people use less bags. And that's essentially what we need to do. We need to produce less and use less. But I can tell you that there is a very strong effort to fight these bans. And the reason, I can tell you that the groups behind it are in large part the companies that profit from the production of bags, which isn't that surprising, right? That is the case. And it was really interesting to find, to look at the effort to fight these. And that was sort of how I got in the story in the first place. It turned into, as you mentioned, a really, really long story. But initially I thought, let me look at, we had a plastic bag ban come up and eventually pass in New York, but it took a while, and there was all this pushback. And I knew that from polling and just the vast majority of voters and New Yorkers wanted this ban. And I thought, well, what is going on that it doesn't get through the first time, and that the governor puts came up with this delay for a year to study it and all this. And I thought, wow, the opposition must be so strong. Where is this coming from? And when I started digging into it, I realized, wow, there's this incredibly well-organized effort to fight these bans. And so I ended up going to a conference where I got to see the kind of mastermind of the ban on bans, this guy named Matt Seaholm, and it was really illuminating. You know, it's a well-funded effort. This guy Matt Seaholm is the executive director of the American Progressive Bag Alliance, which is this group which is kind of an offshoot now of the Plastics Industry Association, the trade group. And basically, he's out there fighting local, like state-level, but also town, you know, community-level bans really, really hard with the support of the industries that make plastic.
So let's talk about this. What a name, the American Progressive Bag Alliance. You report that the group includes Shell Polymers, ExxonMobil, Chevron, Phillips, Dow, DuPont. They all profit hugely from the continuing production of plastics. Let's go a little deeper into that Tennessee bill, because you write that the American Progressive Bag Alliance supported a bill in Tennessee that would ban local governments from regulating plastic bags and utensils. Mm-hmm. So Memphis and Nashville wanted to levy taxes against plastic bags to reduce waste. Mm-hmm. And so what happened in Tennessee?
So, well, ultimately, they did pass the ban. And they passed the ban in part by this group, the APBA, you know, lobbying against it, and by industry making a lot of contributions to state legislators. But basically, the one of the things that I report on in Tennessee is a contest in a school. And this is what they did was it. They had a bunch of school kids make it was a contest for school kids to make different receptacles for plastic bags. And you know, kids do this with a whole, like a open heart and think that, you know, the idea was they want to help prevent plastic pollution. They weren't able, you know, basically, so this group that I write about, the school in Tennessee, was the one that won that contest. And what they don't know, what the kids don't know, is that the contest itself was sponsored by the American Progressive Bag Alliance. So it makes it seem like a green group, when in fact, at the same time that it's doing this, it was backing the state bill that would have, and eventually did, strip Tennesseans of their right to address the plastics crisis through bans. So it's really, it's a double-edged problem.
You report that 11 states have enacted these so-called bans on bans, and according to Matt Seaholm, 42% of Americans now live in states where they cannot pass local bans on plastics.
Yeah, right.
Let's talk about some of the other kind of front groups out there. You write that other plastic industry lobbying groups, including ALEX, American City County Exchange, and this is the American Legislative Exchange Council, and the National Federation of Independent Business, have argued for preemption on the grounds that bans hurt businesses. So they basically say it's bad for businesses, it's bad for poor people. And over the year, the Flexible Packaging Association, whose members include Chevron, Exxon, and Dow, more than doubled its spending nationwide, and the group significantly upped its contributions to Tennessee lawmakers in the year leading up to the passage of this bag preemption bill.
And that's, I mean, and Tennessee is not an exception. I use it as an example, but that's basically how it's been playing out across the country. It really doesn't take that much. When I actually looked at the contributions, the campaign contributions in Tennessee, it's like, you know, 3,000 here, 4,000 there. It doesn't take a huge amount, but when it happens around the country, you know, it's really an effective way of making legislation happen, or in this case, not happen.
Today we're speaking with Sharon Lerner, who has written extensively about the plastics and chemical industries. She's an award-winning health and environment reporter for The Intercept, and she has, I hope you can read her stories, because she really gives us an insight about how the plastics industry has a long history of blaming citizens for pollution. They're waging a fight against environmentalists who are working to reduce plastic waste, and then, as we talked about, they are working with states to pass these so-called bans on bans. Sharon, since you talked about this industry conference, I mean, this was fascinating to read about. In your piece, you quote Gary Cole of PepsiCo. And in April, he told fellow members of the plastics industry, all we hear is you've got to get rid of the plastics. And they were talking about just how bad this all looks because you've got these dead plastic-filled albatross. You have the video of the turtle with a plastic straw in its nose. And he says, this is very emotional for our senior leaders. They're all talking about the albatross. So tell us what happened when he brought that up.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was really interesting to be at this industry conference. It was a fairly small conference. And it was all these different folks involved in different aspects of plastics production and marketing and then the brands that use it. And, of course, Cole is one of those. He represents Pepsi. This has turned into a huge battle, right? It is industry versus environmentalists and in some way, right? And it's super interesting to hear how it feels for the folks on the other side. So Cole of Pepsi, you know, I think he and others seem genuinely distraught by the fact that their product is causing, causing huge environmental destruction. And I should say pretty much everyone at this conference I was at seemed to be in some level of anguish about this, with the exception of Matt Seaholm, who seemed to just, he literally said, you know, that he put the names of environmental groups up in his PowerPoint and presentation and essentially said, they're the enemy. If they're mad, we're doing something right. You know, he clearly enjoys the antagonism. The other folks, including Cole, seem very to be distraught again about their role in it. And quite really interestingly, right after this piece ran, both Pepsi and Coke announced they were leaving this group, the Plastics Industry Association, which is a very big and important step. And not just because of this piece, I think people have been pushing them for years because they and other brands, they make these public pledges, these sustainability pledges, saying, you know, we're companies that care. We know what we're doing. And to be to say that publicly, and then to basically fund Matt Seaholm's Progressive Bag Alliance, it's, you know, going around the country limiting people's ability to deal with waste. It's a clear conflict, and I think that Pepsi and Coke finally saw that. So that's really exciting. Many others in the group haven't yet. Left. But anyway, I think that a big piece of this really comes from this growing public recognition of the extent of the problem. And, you know, partly it's social media. It's these, this theater turtle video has been viewed millions of times. And there's no way you can look at that without feeling that we are destroying nature on some level, that like the whatever you get out of a straw, it is not worth, it's not worth destroying wildlife. And I feel like these, that video and the albatross that you mentioned, that image, they're so powerful. And also these images now coming out of Asia, so many different countries where you see these mountains of plastic waste. Mm-hmm. It is staggering, the visuals, and people understand. They understand what it means, that it's not worth it for, you know, to have your cupcake covered in clear plastic for 3 seconds to do this to anyone and to the planet. I think people get it, and it's sort of welling up in this way that industry is being forced to deal with.
And earlier you said something interesting, and I feel like this is becoming a theme on the shows around major change. The industry is going to fight until the end, and this is going to be a very ugly fight because there's so much money at stake. I mean, we just did a show about how Berkeley, California became the first city in the country to require low-level buildings to be electric rather than natural gas. And SoCal Gas in Southern California is fighting this by working directly with local governments. And so as you write in the story, and this is another interesting piece, something to really think about. So when you were at that conference, you wrote, the industry is gearing up, the plastics industry is gearing up for the fight of its life, which may explain why an expert in actual warfare gave the keynote of the plastics conference.
Yeah.
So tell us about that.
So, interestingly, the person who spoke as the keynote was Navy Commander Kirk Lippold, who was the captain of the USS Cole, which was attacked in, I guess it was 2000.
Right.
And basically, it was, it was shot at, it was exploded, there were explosions on board his ship, and he tells this gruesome tale to the plastics executives about, there's blood and there's shrapnel everywhere and the water is coming in. And basically it's this awful story about what happened to his ship and his sailors. And it ends with the boat kind of sailing off, even though it's sort of hobbled but is able to sail, and they blast the national anthem as they sail off. And it really, I'm not sure what their thinking was when they signed him up to be the keynote, but it really seemed to me that this was, on some level, there was this parallel to what the industry is facing. They're very much under attack. But, the spirit of this conference, and something I heard again and again, is they're not just about, we got to fend off this attack. What they're looking at as they look ahead is actually massive growth. Mm-hmm. And already you can see that what's been produced in the past few years is the equivalent of, all the plastic that's been produced. I don't have the exact numbers, but it's decades worth have we matched that in the past few years because production is already accelerating so much. And that's largely because the fossil fuels that primarily natural gas that are used to make plastic that create ethylene is so cheap now. It costs them virtually nothing. So there's lots and lots of room to profit. And even if there are increasing restrictions in the U.S., which I think that the industry recognizes as inevitable, they are anticipating and banking on growth elsewhere. I don't even think they know where else exactly right now, but the assumption is that they will be able to sell this somewhere, and they will be able to continue to take this stuff out of the ground, turn it into plastic, and profit, and pollute without, even though we don't have a solution for what to do with this stuff after it's produced.
And you report, we're going to take a quick break, but you report that the price drop in oil and gas has led to more than 700 plastics industry projects now in the works, including expansions of old plants and the construction of new ones by Chevron, Shell, Dow, Exxon, Formosa Plastics, Nova Chemicals, and Bayport Polymers, among other companies. We're going to take a quick break. You can find Sharon Lerner's piece, How the Plastics Industry is Fighting to Keep Polluting the World, at yourcallradio.org. Sharon Lerner has written extensively about the plastics and chemical industry. She's an award-winning health and environment reporter for The Intercept. This is Your Calls One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about the plastics crisis in this country and really around the globe with Sharon Lerner, who's written extensively about plastic and the chemical industry. Sharon is an award-winning health and environment reporter for The Intercept and a reporting fellow at Type Investigations. And you can find her work at yourcallradio.org. So, Sharon, we were talking about how the industry is not just concerned about the plastic they're producing today, but they're also concerned about the profits that they could make in the future. And as you report, falling oil and gas prices mean that the cost of making new plastic, which is already very low, will be even cheaper. And they've got about 700 projects in the works. So let's talk about what plastic is actually made of. As you report, more than 99% of plastic is derived from oil, natural gas, and coal.
Yep.
And so this means that that adds about 850 million metric tons of greenhouse gas to the atmosphere every year.
Right. So, and so this piece really helped me kind of put together and understand how big a driver of climate change plastic is. And often I think in the environmental world, we kind of think of pollution and chemicals on the one hand and climate on the other, these kind of two separate huge environmental issues. And here with plastic, you see them all come together because the chemicals that we're talking about and the production of plastic is a driver of climate change, as you just said, because it's made with coal from coal, oil, and natural gas. And so you have to get it out from the ground, and then you have to use energy to produce this stuff. But it's also the chemical additives to plastic, and many of which are petrochemicals, so also made from these same original sources, end up being... Some of them are very toxic. Many of them we don't understand, actually, how toxic they are because they haven't been studied. But some that have been studied, we actually know to be quite dangerous.
And most of the chemicals that are used are not regulated?
Well, that's true of chemicals in general, unfortunately.
Right.
The vast majority of chemicals, there are more than 40,000 in use now, and I think it's less than 2% have even been really studied and subject to any kind of, restrictions. Yeah, so the vast majority are not regulated, and the vast majority have not been studied at all. I did speak with some chemists who have looked at additives to plastic, and I should say, so there's the chemicals that are sort of used, made in the production of plastic, and then there are chemicals that are added to it to give it, like, color and flexibility and all the different properties. And these additives, some of them we know to be particularly dangerous. And interestingly, so if they're in the original product, when you recycle these plastics, they're in that recycled plastic too. So the way this was explained to me best was by this scientist who studies black plastic. Mm-hmm. And basically what he said is that black plastic, which is often made from melting down electronics, is some of the most dangerous chemicals in it. And that's, because these are things like flame retardants that are allowed to be used internally in things like radios and other electronic products. But when you melt them down and turn them into, like, kitchen utensils and children's toys and whatever, those chemicals remain, and some of them are quite dangerous again. So they're like flame retardants, heavy metals, phthalates, cadmium, mercury. These things were detected by the scientists I spoke to when he looked at things like toys and utensils and realized, wow, some of them have these chemicals at really, really high levels, and levels that you might see, like with electronics, you sometimes have, limits set on these chemicals, but when you melt them down and turn it into something else, like even a fork, then those items don't necessarily have any limits on them. Does that make sense?
Yes. And the scientists told you that even at very low levels, these chemicals can cause serious reproductive and developmental problems. So when we talk about black plastic, Sharon, is the plastic actually black?
Yeah. When you go to a takeout place and they give you a black fork?
Yes.
That's what we're talking about.
Okay.
And the takeout containers that are black. I have to say, like, when I first learned about this, I was with an environmental chemist, and, he said, he told me about this actually a couple of years ago and said that he was studying all the additives in plastic and that, pro tips, stay away from black plastic. Then I started looking around and realized, like, wow, so many things that come into contact with food, like the takeout containers and forks and knives and spoons, are in fact black plastic. And So, and I talked to two different scientists who study this, and both of them said, "Yeah, we don't use that.
Wow.
If given the option, we will not use plastic utensils, and especially not black ones."
Black plastic is also used to make cell phone cases and thermoses.
Yeah.
Okay, so people need to. I never even thought about a difference between the cream plastic, the white plastic, and the black plastic.
Why would you, right?
Right.
But then you realize, like, all the kids, how many, like, black plastic spatulas,
wow.
And, like, there are all these, even whisks, like, there are all these things that are made of black plastic that are used in the kitchen.
Wow.
So that's also pretty alarming.
I mean, I'm looking right now in my radio studio. It looks like the computer has some black plastic on it, the microphones.
Right, and all that, I mean, it's well known. This is like a whole other issue that you can put flame retardants and all these other chemicals into electronics.
Mm.
And this we know, and is a somewhat, but it's sort of when you melt that down and then process it into a baby toy and things like, it was like Rubik's Cubes, things like those kinds of items ended up having incredibly high readings of some of these chemicals.
Wow.
Because essentially they're melted, they are created from melted down electronics in many cases.
Okay, so that's black plastic.
Mm-hmm.
After reading your story, I try so hard, like a lot of people, to try to be as plastic-free as possible. But then I was using my toothpaste, and
yeah.
That's usually in a plastic tube. Your shampoo, conditioner, your
yeah.
soaps. I mean, there's so much that you just deal
and
with every day.
It is very overwhelming. And as I was writing this piece, I found that I was almost unable to grocery shop anymore. Like, I'd walk into the grocery store and just be paralyzed by looking around and realizing that absolutely everything is in plastic. I think that, that's not so helpful,
yeah.
of course. And basically, I of necessity, it's worth struggling to try to not let it overwhelm you because it is very overwhelming. But there are some things you can do, and there are simple things, some of them, like bringing your own coffee cup with you, bringing like a spoon, metal spoon and fork with you, which I have in my bag now, or, and of course bringing bags with you instead of using bags, and these things are actually pretty huge in a water bottle. These things are really big. And then, bringing little, like, even bulk food bags. But, yeah, it's everywhere. I mean, one of the things that's been driving me nuts lately is the plastic windows in cardboard boxes of, like, pasta and things like that.
Mm.
Like, all of a sudden, you can't even get a cardboard box that doesn't have a plastic window for everything. Even this made me completely nuts the other day. A bamboo toothbrush. Okay, so someone somewhere gets why it's useful not to have a plastic toothbrush and not to have plastic bristles. So it was a bamboo toothbrush in a cardboard box with a plastic window so you could see the bamboo toothbrush.
What did the scientists tell you about children? Because reading about this black plastic, it just made me think about all the kids that deal with all these toys or, what if you get a black food package and then you heat it up and then you stick a black plastic fork in that heated pasta, for example.
Right. So, I mean, are you going to drop dead the next instant? No. But what I have learned, I feel like, over years of reporting on chemicals is, we're all exposed in so many ways every day.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, if you heat plastic, it's more likely to end up in your food, and it is not a good idea to heat your food in black plastic and stick your fork in it. Absolutely not. And at the same time, I think we all want to be thinking about just reducing as much as possible. There are going to be situations where you might end up eating that because you don't have another choice. But yeah, if you can avoid it, right?
Yeah, if you can avoid it. Today we're speaking with Sharon Lerner, who writes extensively about the plastics and chemical industry. She's an award-winning health and environment reporter for The Intercept. You can find her work at yourcallradio.org. Sharon, another theme that's come up, I mean, this just happens pretty regularly. Like every 6 months, we get a bunch of emails from listeners saying, things are pretty dire, and we talk about these things every day on this show. It's sometimes a little overwhelming. And
yeah.
Someone said, what can we do? I mean, this is always the question. And
yeah.
Thinking about the plastics, when you learn about these front groups that are so heavily funded, passing bans on bans, This administration is working against international efforts to crack down on plastic waste. It's just so unfair for the onus to always be on the individual.
Right.
You know, beyond doing all those things which are important, what else can we do to take this on?
Well, so I think, you know, I do think that consumer pressure is really important. And, like, you know, I tweeted at the companies, a couple of companies that were putting organic vegetables in single-use plastic, and, you know, and got a response. And you know, there's some of that that is really useful to let companies know, like, we see this and this is absurd and stop, please. Mm-hmm. And I think that can sometimes be useful. I think also politically, what we have to do is focus on the companies as opposed to the individuals. So while we do need to keep doing things like avoiding plastic, letting companies that are working to stop using it, that we know that we appreciate it, you know, letting the companies that don't get it know that we don't appreciate that or we want them to get it. You know, I will sometimes tell folks, I'm not going to get this because of your packaging, just so you know, FYI, that kind of thing.
Right.
But, you know, that's time-consuming and whatever. But in terms of the bigger picture, this problem is not caused by individuals, right? I mean, we're complicit in it and we're wrapped up in it because, because we live in this world and participate in this economy. But I think this is sort of the overarching efforts of industry has been to focus on individuals. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, I write a lot about Keep America Beautiful, which is actually, you know, we know it as this anti-litter organization, but it is actually was begun by beverage companies, Philip Morris, and other companies that were actually creating litter. And part of what they've done over the years has really shifted the emphasis for responsibility for the problem of plastics and pollution generally, but plastics in particular, on consumers. So the litter bug, right? And I write about the 1971 Crying Indian ad, where people may be familiar with that, which was the tear that's rolling down the Indian's face. And I'm making air quotes because the Indian was actually an Italian-American actor. But the gist of this thing was, hey, you guys are polluting the world and you got to stop. Take it seriously. Well, in fact, the folks who were funding that ad were the companies that were profiting from packaging their, you know, from the packaging that was ending up in the streets and whatnot. So that, you know, is from the 60s. Well, that ad was 71, but that tech, I think, was sort of started even before then. And we still, to this day, are sort of suffering under that same framework where it's like, litter bugs, you got to stop. Keep America Beautiful, in fact, is still going strong, has these affiliates all over the country, and their emphasis is you guys have to stop littering, while at the same time they are waging sort of a separate battle to fend off efforts to stop production of plastic and also to do things like bottle bills.
You also report that, like Exxon and Chevron and companies that knew about the dangers of greenhouse gas emissions back in the 70s, you report that these strategies that you're talking about today date back to at least 1969, when an editorial in Modern Plastics magazine warned about the impending waste crisis. The big plastic makers were already aware of the problem. You report that year, DuPont, Chevron, Dow, and the Society for the Plastics Industry were among the groups represented at a conference on packaging waste. And when the first Earth Day was launched in 1970, to tackle the crisis, the industry was ready.
Right. And so you could do, you know, the hashtag Exxon knew about climate change. Well, you can certainly do it about the plastics crisis, too. You know, Exxon knew, Chevron knew, DuPont knew, American Chemistry Council knew, and they're, you know, with the other parallels with climate, and again, it's a driver of climate change. It's not even a separate issue from climate, but also the parallel with the shifting of responsibility, right? So there's all this focus with climate on individual solutions, when we know that, you know, it's a small number of companies that are creating the vast majority of the problem. So, yeah, I do think they knew, and I think that just as, you know, you can see this going back decades, that they saw this coming, and, you know, in, I believe it was 69, I know, in the late 60s, there were a couple of federal bills that the American, that the beverage industry fought really hard against and successfully against. One of them would have banned single-use packaging, because we forget about this, but back then it was a new thing. Right now it's just like this part is so deep in our culture. But in fact, there was a time before we would get a soda, drink it, and toss the container. It just wasn't a thing yet. So back then, it was an affront to people's sensibilities. Like, why would you do that? It was very clear that it was going to create a huge problem. And there was a response to it that was successfully fought off by the beverage industry. And so, yeah, I think it's quite appropriate to say that they knew.
And I really appreciate your reporting on this, Sharon, because it's so important to learn about really how we got here. Again, you report future Earth Days would continue to emphasize consumers' personal responsibility for recycling, including the national commemoration of the 10th Earth Day in 1980, which was organized by Michael McCabe, a former legislative assistant who would go on to serve as Joe Biden's communications and special projects director before he spearheaded DuPont's defense of the dangerous chemical PFOA. And then you report in 1990, the 20th anniversary celebration was marked by a celebrity-studded TV special that emphasized the importance of individuals' actions, including tree planting and recycling, in order to protect the environment.
Right. And again, I feel the need to say, do plant trees. Do recycle.
I was thinking that as I was reading
it. Can be recycled, right? Like cans and maybe numbers, bottles number 1 and 2, and every so often containers made out of number 5 plastic. Do those things. But it's not, this problem is not going to be resolved by fastidious, you know, individuals who care. You know, we can't do this alone. If the industry continues to generate ridiculous amounts of plastic that we don't need, we just can't do it. It's not possible.
What about this sustainable packaging coalition that you write about? Because I'm hearing this now from a lot of companies that our packaging is sustainable, especially when they have these, I guess they're kind of like green food conferences, you know, or natural food conferences, and they say they use sustainable packaging. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it's really complicated stuff. Not the coalition yet, but just the issue. Because, well, the big point is that just because something is recyclable, which is to say that it theoretically could be repurposed into another item, does not mean that it will be. So a lot of companies now are making a big deal about the fact that something, that their bottles or cups or whatever are recyclable. Mm-hmm. But if, in fact, they won't be recycled, then it doesn't matter if it's recyclable. So the vast majority of all that waste we were talking about in the beginning that's in the oceans and in landfills and has been burnt, that was much of that recyclable. But if it doesn't actually get recycled, it doesn't matter if it theoretically could have been. Like, I theoretically could be, you know, the King of England, but I'm not. So, to state the obvious. So, with recycling, I mean, to make that point, because, and I singled out Starbucks at one point because they really went over the top with their, all this hype about their recyclable drink lid, and they, you know, they had this huge campaign, I think it was, in the beginning, it was about a year ago when they announced that they were going to replace the lid that had straws with a new recyclable lid. And it was this big environmental milestone that they said was going to replace more than 1 billion straws each year. But if you're replacing 1 billion straws with 1 billion lids that have a little kind of bend in them, it doesn't matter if it's recyclable if it's not actually going to get recycled. And the plastic that lid was made out of is number 5, which is very difficult to recycle in many places. And of course, also, you know, they're talking about a billion straws around the world. Well, they operate in many, I think it's 75 countries, you know, the vast majority of which don't have recycling infrastructure to begin with. So if they're producing a bill, you know, you get my point.
Right.
So recyclable is not actually the same as something that's going to get recycled. So there are a whole bunch of scams along these lines, and I tackled a few of them, but there are many more. So, for instance, there is this how to recycle kind of symbol that a group called the Sustainable Packaging Coalition has been putting on various packages. And again, when you look at the board of how to recycle, of the Sustainable Packaging Coalition, it's executives from Dow and Target and Amazon and the big companies that are making some of the products that are at issue here, right? So the problem with this, with the how to recycle label, is that it makes them look a lot easier to recycle than they are. So again, if it's theoretically recyclable, it might get this how to recycle symbol on it, even though it might not be recyclable, you know, even it might not be able to be recycled in the vast majority of the country.
Blue Bottle just announced, they made a lot of headlines for saying, we're not going to give out these single-use cups anymore. Bring your own or buy one from us, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
When you think about the fact that, oh gosh, I'm just looking at this Fast Company piece about Blue Bottle. Every year, 250 billion of these cups end up in landfills.
Yeah, it's so insane.
Wow.
And it's the insane part, aside from so to take a step back, you know this, but plastic doesn't break down. It's not like, okay, in 10 years or in 20 years or even in 30 years or even 100 years, it'll be okay. It will eventually, you know, break into smaller pieces, but it doesn't actually decompose. So when you think about the fact of, like, you're getting a cup of coffee and then you're putting an item into the ground for maybe hundreds of years, it doesn't make any sense, particularly when you realize that there's this really viable solution, which is a cup that isn't disposable. We had this before the cups that weren't disposable. There is a solution. Just use one of those cups.
Right. And then, of course, when the sun hits that plastic, it turns into microplastic and the fish eat it and the whales. You have a great piece about Coca-Cola. They make 117 billion plastic bottles a year, according to their own estimate. This is 117 billion every single year.
Right. And that's their own estimates. And there are so many issues here. The piece that was in is actually based on audio from a meeting that happened in Atlanta, Georgia, where Coca-Cola was giving money to some recycling organizations, basically to the city of Atlanta, for recycling. And the recycling leaders, who were, you know, local folks who had met to discuss this donation, they're in this meeting, and one of them brings up the possibility that they would use some of the money to start a bottle bill, basically a program where you can have a deposit be part of the price of a drink, and then you get it back when you return the bottle. And this is actually, you know, very old method and really effective for increasing recycling rates. And very quickly, and we have the audio from this in the piece, it becomes really clear that some of the people at the meeting feel that Coke would never be okay with this. We cannot use the money that way, is what they end up saying. And these are folks who are getting money from Coca-Cola in their organization. Mm-hmm. So basically, to take a step back, it's sort of looking at how Coke, in this case, is incredibly, you know, this incredibly powerful company, is using its money not directly to influence policy, but through these recycling nonprofits that seem like, you know, very green and do-good organizations. But in fact, what they're doing is sort of gumming up the works and making it more difficult to recycle.
Well, Sharon, unfortunately, we're out of time. And I just want to say, you know, as much as this is overwhelming and your piece, I just felt like my mouth was dropped the entire time. But we have to know what we're up against in order to take this on. I mean, for me, it's like these poor sea creatures, these dolphins and whales and, you know, these turtles. It's they it's not their fault. They can't do anything about this. I mean, we have to do what we can to try to save them.
Yeah.
So, you know, thank you so much for your great reporting.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about it.
Well, we'll definitely have you back. Sharon Lerner has written extensively about plastic and the chemical industry. She's an award-winning health and environment reporter for The Intercept. Find her pieces at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show and Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Calls One Planet series. On the next Your Call, Jennifer Gaddis will discuss her new book, The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. Over 32 million children participate in the National School Lunch Program. In many schools, large companies supply cafeterias with cheap, unhealthy food. What will it take to ensure healthy food for students and living wage jobs for cafeteria workers? Join the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.